Culture Podcast, where we're interviewing the people behind the chair and the people that make your natural hair products. I'm your host, Candace, and today we have a very, very special guest. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Alelia Bundles, and I am Madam C.J. Walker's great-great-granddaughter and biographer.
All right, so give us a little history, and if anybody doesn't know about Madam C.J. Walker's history, shame on you, okay? Because you should know this, but we still go.
Great. Well, yes, I will tell you, I hope that they will check out my website, madamcjwalker.com, madamcjwalker.com, and my books about her on her own ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker, is the major book. So I've been writing about her for a long time, but I grew up in a household with two parents who worked in the hair care industry. My mom was vice president of the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company, and my dad was president of Summit Laboratories. So both of my, we went to hair shows during the summer. So I grew up really around the hair business.
Okay. So how do you feel being part of the Madam C.J. Walker industry, like growing up, hearing the history about it, parents still involved in it? How do you keep the legacy going?
I grew up in a household with both parents who worked in the hair care industry. So I'm 71. So that means in the 1950s and 1960s.
You look fabulous. Yes.
Thank you. But that means in the 1950s and 1960s, I was, you know, observing what was happening in the hair care industry. My mom was vice president of the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company. And my dad was president of Summit Laboratories, another Black hair care company. So we went to hair shows in the summer. So I, you know, and spent a lot of time in beauty shops, and with my dad going to drugstores, looking at what the shelf, you know, what was the shelf space was, how many inches of products were on the shelf space. So I grew up, you know, knowing something about hair care, but my real passion was writing, and my parents really encouraged me to follow my passion. And I came to writing about Madam C.J. Walker later in life when I was in graduate school in journalism. But I really, my parents were, they sort of set a great example for me as entrepreneurs. And I began to learn about Madam Walker, not because my parents said, you know, not because we sat around the dinner table talking about it, but because I had this kind of context of the history of Black hair care. So Madam C.J. Walker was born Sarah Breedlove in Delta, Louisiana in 1867, the first child in her family born free. She was orphaned at 7, married at 14 to get away from, she said, a cruel brother-in-law. Had her only child, Lelia, when she was 17. And then her husband died when she was 20. So she moved up the river from Louisiana to St. Louis, where her older brothers had moved a decade earlier. They had become barbers at a time when Black men dominated the barbering trade. That's a little known history fact, that Black men were the main barbers when men had to be shaved every day. And so she began to learn something about hair care from them, but she was losing her hair. And like so many people who start businesses today, she was trying to solve a personal problem. In the 1800s, most Americans didn't have indoor plumbing. They didn't have electricity. So you couldn't just jump in the shower in the morning, you know, take a shower and wash your hair. It was a much more complicated process. And as a result, people didn't wash their hair very often. So they had not just dandruff, they had scalp infections, and I mean really serious, severe scalp infections. And as a result, she was going bald. So she, having learned something from her brothers for a while, she sold products for Annie Malone, who became her main competitor. As she sold products for Malone, she moved to Denver, where she was a cook for a pharmacist who had the largest pharmacy west of the Mississippi. He saw that she was trying to sell products, but there were already things already on the market. Cuticure is a name that we know well, but they were expensive products. And he said, you know, this is not a new formula. It's been around for hundreds of years. You can make your own. And so she began to make her own products. Her good friend, Charles Joseph Walker, who was a newspaper man in St. Louis, moved to Denver. And they went into business together. And she began to sell Madam C.J. Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower. So that's how she started her business. And then ultimately, She developed a company where she employed thousands of women, Black women, who at the time were mostly working as farmers and sharecroppers and domestic workers, provided them an opportunity to make money, to create generational wealth. And then she used a lot of her money as a philanthropist, a political activist, and a patron of the arts.
Watching the film, was you part of making the film?
So you're talking about the Netflix series?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, there's another film that I really recommend to people called $2 and a Dream. It's a documentary and it's nonfiction, which means factual, that was produced by Stanley Nelson, whose grandfather, Effie Ransom, was Madam Walker's attorney. The Netflix series is a fictional version. Octavia Spencer was great. And it was my book was On Her Own Ground is a nonfiction, deeply researched, factual book that was optioned by a studio to make the film. But the showrunners, who were Black women, decided that they wanted to change the story a lot. And so, again, while I think Octavia was great and lots of people really worked hard on it, I really ultimately have to say I'm not a big fan of the series. I know that people were entertained. I know that people were inspired by some aspects of it, but here's what I have major problems with. Excuse me. The showrunners who, you know, they really kind of use these Hollywood cliches that I think are really, I personally think are insulting to Black women, because they decided they were going to pit two Black women against each other. They decided to make up a theme of colorism that was not part of Madam Walker's competition with Annie Malone. And so they wanted that to be the reason that they were in conflict. That was absolutely not true. Though both women were very successful, both were made a big difference for Black women, and to have them as in a cat fight, I just personally found offensive. And I think people were so hungry sometimes to see ourselves that we don't critique things in that way.
I'm glad you brought it up, because when I watched it, I was like, wow, this is not helping the African-American community, seeing two people fight against each other instead of actually working together. So I'm glad that you're clearing this up.
Yeah. I mean, you know, here's what, I mean, I've said this before, but I was hoping for Hidden Figures, the inspiration of Hidden Figures. And I feel instead like I got Real Housewives of Atlanta. And I know a lot of people love that show. I'm not a particular fan, but, you know, everybody has their own, you know, their own likes and dislikes. But I thought it was just kind of a cheap trick to just, you know, do that, and to have these two women fighting each other, when the reality for Madam Walker is that when she was still a poor washerwoman in St. Louis, the St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church was very near her brother's barbershop. And she joined the church, and she's still, you know, struggling, almost homeless sometimes, trying to raise her daughter. But she had a good enough voice to be in the choir. So she joined the choir. She became a member of the Missionary Society, even though she didn't have a lot, but she was learning from these more educated women in the church. And it was those women who supported her and began to give her a vision of herself as something other than an illiterate washerwoman. They encouraged her to go to school. They made sure her daughter was enrolled in school. So it was that kind of support and collaboration of women working together that is really her story. And so that when she began to become successful and teaching other women, training other women, helping them get education, she had learned those lessons because other women had supported her. That's really her story, not this made up story of her, you know, fighting with another woman. Now, these two women were competitors. Mm-hmm. You know, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates are competitors.
Yes.
Edison and Tesla were competitors. Yep. Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola are competitors. But that, her story, I just think is really distorted. And so it was a disappointment for me, as hard as, you know, as excited as I was about Octavia Spencer, and as excited as I was about more people knowing who Madam Walker is, I'm really frustrated that I have to tell people that, you know, do not believe this story, unfortunately. Please read my book.
Yes. Thank you. You said that there was another movie that you want everybody to look at.
Yeah. So it's and you can watch it for free on YouTube. It's called $2 and a Dream. Now, it was done in 1989, so it's, you know, it's been around for a while. But for me, the strength of it is that there are some of the people who were in, at that point in their 80s and 90s, who had worked for the Walker Company, who, you know, who knew Madam Walker and her daughter, who talked about what the pride that they had in working for the company. So it will, you know, it's different from a Hollywood movie, but it is a very, I think, useful piece of information. There's another series that Stanley Nelson, the filmmaker, did called Boss, the Black Experience in Business. Mm-hmm. And there is a segment about Madam Walker and Annie Malone that's part of, I think his series is maybe a couple of episodes. But if you look for Boss, Black Experience in Business on PBS, people should be able to find the segment on Madam Walker. And it's also on my website. So my website, aleliabundles.com, A-L-E-L-I-A bundles.com. I have some video clips, and I think that video, those video clips are there. You know, I mean, there's so much for me. There's so much about Madam Walker's story that is true that I find so much more inspiring than the way that they sort of twisted that story. I mean, I tell you, I'm laughing now, but it was very annoying to me that the process of having your book optioned, you know, I'm almost, in fact, I'll just show you, this is the manuscript for a new biography that I've written about Madam Walker's daughter, Alelia Walker, who was nothing like the character in the movie. I mean, it's just like, oh, it just made me cringe. I'm so sorry to say. But yeah. When your book is optioned, you know, you hand it over to a studio, and then if you're lucky, you participate. I made a particular deal with a studio because I thought I was going to be involved. But once they assigned a writer, the writer had her own ideas, and they intentionally left me out of the process of creating, pitching to the studio. But the contract said that I had what is called script review, which meant they had to let me see the scripts before they started shooting. So we had to fight with them to get that. Finally, they sent me the script, and I had really kind of lowered my bar to the point where I said, just, you know, don't make me cringe. I mean, that was really how low my bar was. But when I got the script, I cringed, because what they did, they had taken these two characters and they had Madam Walker and her competitor calling each other the N word and the B word. Mm-hmm. And they were physically fighting. And I'm like, really? Why would you do that? Because it's not, that's Real Housewives of Atlanta. But it's, you know, Black women, it's not like Black women don't know how to throw shade. And it's not like Black women in the late 1800s and early 1900s did not throw shade. But they were much more refined about it. Yes, they were much more sophisticated about it. So.
And the way Hollywood is that the spice of a film, the world will be attracted to that instead of what the real truth is. So everybody's going on what's going on the film instead of actually what happened in reality.
And our reality, I think there are directors who, Ava DuVernay, I think is one, who are telling our stories with dignity. And it's not like we don't have conflict. It's not like we don't have scandal. I mean, that's, you know, that's life. But I don't, but you use the real scandal.
Yeah, the real story.
You know, there's enough drama in the real life stuff to not sort of play it. It's kind of, you know, people's insecurities.
Yes. Okay. I do have a question for you. Okay. So during the film, I know that back then the beauty salons and the barbers, they all came together and they all paid ways for the civil rights back then, like, you know. Is that true inside of the document?
The documentary, $2 and a Dream, doesn't so much talk about that, and definitely Self-Made, they didn't they didn't lean into any of the sort of collaboration between the Black beauticians. But here's one of the things that I really wished had been in the film. And if I get a chance to do another one, this is one scene that I would focus on. In 1917, Madam Walker had her first convention of her sales agents. Mm-hmm. 200 women came from all of the United States, the Caribbean, and Central America. And these are women who had worked as, you know, sharecroppers, farmers, maids, laundresses, cooks. And they now were in business for themselves. And they're coming to this convention, as we go to conventions today, to learn new skills, to network, to do all those things. And so these women had come together in what I'm sure had to have been one of the very first conventions of women entrepreneurs. And at that convention, Madam Walker gave prizes, not just to the women who had sold the most products or recruited the most new sales agents, but also to the women who had contributed the most to charity in their communities. She was trying to help them become leaders. And she said in her keynote address, "I want you to understand that your first duty is to humanity. I want others to look at us and realize that we care not just about ourselves, but about others." And at the end of the convention, the women sent a telegram to President Woodrow Wilson to urge him to support legislation to make lynching a federal crime. Now, for your listeners who are paying attention to politics now, who are paying attention to social justice, that anti-lynching bill was finally signed by President Biden within the last couple of years, but they began working on that more than a century ago. So she was very politically conscious. And that sense of organizing and that sense of being community leaders carried forward through the next decades with a group called the National Beauty Culturist League. And those women, the leadership of those organizations, were very involved in politics, very involved in voting rights. When Martin Luther King was organizing, he would come speak at their conventions. And so when the March on Washington happened in 1963, it was organized by A. Philip Randolph. His wife, Lucille Green Randolph, was a Madam Walker agent. She had been a friend of Madam Walker's and Madam Walker's daughter. The women who were beauticians with the National Beauty Culturist League helped to pay for the buses for many people to go to that March on Washington. And this is because the women who were beauticians had their own businesses. They weren't going to be fired by, you know, a white employer. They they had their shops, they had their businesses, they had their own money. And that was the power, those seeds that were planted when Madam Walker was starting her organization. But even take it farther back, the seeds that were planted by the women of the AME Church who had embraced her and helped her begin to see herself as a leader.
Mm. Wow, that's a lot of history. A lot of history.
Wow. You know, I think we're seeing this today. I recently met Monique Rodriguez with Mayal. She just received a Madam Walker Award that the Personal Care Products Council gave. And we give an award every year to an entrepreneur and to a corporate person. And I know she and her husband are doing this kind of work in the community for education. Shea Moisture, which is where the Madam Walker trademark is housed. Shea Moisture was founded by Richelieu Dennis, and Richelieu has what's called community commerce. They give back to the community. When Rich sold Shea Moisture to Unilever, he took part of the proceeds to buy Essence and Essence Fest and to create a venture capital fund for people of color, for entrepreneurs. So he is invested in a number of, you know, well-known lines that we know today, Lip Bar and Mayel and others, so that we're seeing this consciousness among some people in our community who are investing in and supporting Black business.
My question to you is, a lot of businesses, they start up, they do good, and then later on they sell it. How do you feel about that? That you keep the Madam C.J. Walker thing going, but most people sell it at the end.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I think it's much more complicated than, you know, people, it's like you don't, it's not just that people sell it. It's what is, what's the process? What happens on the other end? And in fact, my family was involved with the Walker Company until the 1980s. And the trademark was sold to another company, to a small black company, which really did not, you know, wasn't a major player, didn't really do a lot with it. And then Richelieu Dennis bought that trademark from that other owner. And then once he bought the trademark, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, he reached out to me because he knew that I was Madam Walker's biographer and he knew that I was the person who really knew the history. So I began to work with Shea Moisture and with Rich and his family in telling Madam Walker's story. Then he sold Shea Moisture, which started with his Sierra Leonean grandmother's recipe, to Unilever. But that was a different kind of proposition. And I know people are like, oh, you've sold a company that's black owned, they're going to change the formula, it's not going to be as good.
Yes.
And I know that I understand that is of a concern to people. But I think the difference between some sales where someone just sells it, I mean, you know, people build, you know, they start businesses to sell them. I mean, that is, you know, that is what happens in the corporate world, that they, you know, you have a product that's a good product. Somebody buys it. Sometimes it works out. Sometimes it doesn't work the way you want it. Sometimes the formulas are changed. But that's kind of the way that business works. But there are different, I think there are different models that I've been seeing. So that in Rich's case, part of the, he did not have any intention of selling. But if you want to be international and you want to scale up and you want to have infrastructure to distribute your products, sometimes that's the best way to make sure that the product gets to the next level. And I think that's what he was saying, that Unilever is, as he was trying to distribute internationally, trying to be more active in Africa, Unilever already had that infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But part of what he was able to do was to extract some promises that certain things would happen with the brand inside Unilever, and the money, the profit that he made, he reinvested it in Essence and in Essence Fest and in this venture capital fund that is now an incubator for other black businesses. So it's not just you sell it and you take the money and run, it's you sell it and you figure out how to use it. Now, in the case of the Rodriguezes and Mael, they are still, even though they've sold the company to Procter & Gamble, they're still running the company, and they're involved in the community. They're investing in the community. So it's, you know, I think it feels painful to people if they say, oh, we don't own this anymore, but it's how do you structure that deal? And that's just kind of a more, you know, sophisticated way of how are you going to upscale and, expand the ownership to other people.
For clarifying that, because a lot of people ask that question. Once you sell a product, are you going to have any input in it? My next question to you is, now that you do everything for Madam C.J. Walker brand, what is it that keeps you going every day? Going forward?
Yeah, well, you know, I just... You know, it's just, now it's become kind of it's fun for me. I mean, it's just, I enjoy telling the story because her life is inspiring to others. But, you know, in my particular case, the last thing I thought I would be doing is this. Like, as I said, we did not sit around the dinner table talking about Madam Walker. My parents really encouraged me to follow my passion, which was writing. They wanted me to have my own thing. And I think, you know, a big part of that is that my mom was the fourth generation of women in her family to work for the Walker Company. And she felt obligated to do that. She wanted me to do the thing that I wanted to do, which was to be a journalist. So I had a 30-year career at ABC News and NBC News as a producer and as an executive. So I was developing my own identity. And I think that was really important. The last thing you want to be is just, you know, you were somebody's great, great granddaughter. And that's all you ever did. You didn't have any other accomplishments. So I think it was important that I do that. And then I learned these skills and I learned leadership and I learned management and how to tell a story and all of those things that I was able then to bring back to expand people's understanding of Madam Walker's legacy. So it's a whole range of things. I've written 4 books. My 5th book will be published next year. I have been on a number of boards and things that are related both to journalism and related to Madam Walker. I'm a consultant on a number of projects, whether it's museum exhibits or, you know, documentaries that people are making. I was a consultant with the Barbie doll, with the Madam Walker Barbie doll that came out. I worked on the Madam Walker stamp. So there are just a whole range of things that we are doing that I think keeps Madam Walker's image and story, before the public in a way that I hope is inspiring. And that's my goal at this point, is just to make sure that her story is something that inspires people. And I will tell you, I'm particularly interested in doing that. One, because I love history, but also because I spent 3 decades as a journalist. Knowing politics, knowing history is very important to me. And it's very important to me right now because there are so many states, Florida, Indiana, Oklahoma, Texas, where there are state legislatures, there are school boards that are trying to prevent us from teaching our history. And so I'm very outspoken about that. And I think that, you know, sometimes our lives can be, you know, so overwhelmed with just the day-to-day stuff that we have to do, you know, getting the kids to school and, yes, you know, going to work and all those things, that it's very hard to think about those things. But our legacy and our future is really threatened if our children do not understand our history. And so I'm just really motivated every single day to make sure that our children learn their history. And it's not just about Madam Walker, it's about their own families, it's about their grandparents, it's about the struggles that each family has, and it's about the accomplishments of each family. That is what's really important to me.
She wanted me to ask you a question. She has a podcast, and hers is called Twin Nation. And one of her questions was, by you being a journalist in your own right, do you have the copy of the original Madam C.J. Walker syllabus from the school?
Yeah, I have the original formulas and I have the original textbook.
Okay.
You know, we're very fortunate that we have an archive of, you know, literally tens of thousands of pages. And this is something that has really allowed me to tell Madam Walker's story. And I think one of the reasons that Madam Walker is, you know, maybe more remembered than some of her contemporaries, some of the people who were her competitors, is that she really had a knack for hiring people who were in her leadership team, her executive team, what we now call the C-suite. Her attorney, F.B. Ransom, the woman who was the manager of her factory, Alice Kelly, had been the dean of girls at a Black school. And while Madam Walker herself did not have a lot of formal education, she brought people around her who could kind of shore up those things that she needed, the assistance she needed. She hired a woman who was a very accomplished bookkeeper. And so those people kept records. They kept her records. They kept her files so that most, there are very few Black-owned companies or women-owned companies from the early 1900s that have their records. The fact that we have our records is what allows us to tell our stories. And so I say to people, you know, if you say, what is Madam Walker's secret to success? It's, you know, first she said you'd have to have a good product, then you have to market it. She would be on TikTok, I know now. And then you have to find people who are skilled, who are talented, who are smart to be part of your executive team. And you have to empower them to do the work. You have to encourage them to be their best selves. And then you have to think about what kind of legacy you're leaving. It's not just that you make money for yourself. It's that you use some of that money to try to improve your community. But having those records is really important. And I know that's something that people don't think about. They don't want to be bothered with it. They don't want to have to hire an attorney. But all of those things made a huge difference for her.
Do you plan on bringing back the Madam C.J. Walker products?
So we have, so with Shea Moisture within Unilever, we've had three different sort of versions. We did a couple of takes with Sephora and kind of a prestige line. So that was a couple of years ago. Then we did a kind of a limited line with Walmart that came out in 2020-21. And now we're figuring out what our next move is going to be. You know, it's such, as you know, a very crowded space. I mean, your audience is making products. So there are literally thousands of people who are making products. And to really break through, you know, it's tough. I mean, when I look at Mayel, what she's done, you know, Beyonce has a hair care line now. So there's, you know, it's a very crowded space. And so we're right now figuring out what is something that we can do that's kind of a limited, you know, line that's a special line that will be interesting to people.
I know one thing as a consumer myself. One of the things that I like to look for is if it's going to cleanse my hair, is it going to help my hair grow? Not only that, the person that actually has the product, are they experiencing the same things that I have experienced? If they're doing TikToks or Instagram or whatever social media site, are they really using it because they like it or because it's a gimmick? Because a lot of times gimmicks is everybody got a gimmick. Everybody got a story. And sometimes they story don't be telling the truth. And you're like, oh, okay, you was Rapunzel now, but 2 months ago you didn't have any hair. So it's kind of hard to really know if the product is really going to work for somebody. So I think if y'all ever do another commercial or whatever it may be, if you have like someone that starts from day one, like, you know, I know y'all got to shorten it up, but you know, day 1, 2, 3, 4, and put it on like YouTube, Instagram, all in places, just so they can say, oh, the product is actually working, instead of saying your hair can look like this too, because not everybody hair can look like it.
I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that with both Camille Rose and Mayel, I mean, I think in both those cases, they were trying to solve a particular problem. With Camille Rose, she was working, her children had a lot of allergies, and I've heard her tell the story that she was trying to find products that worked for them, that didn't irritate them. With Mayel, it was really just sort of overcoming, you know, really difficult, the loss of a child and how she was coming out of that and really trying to create products for herself. So those are, I think, very authentic stories. Mm-hmm. And not some kind of miracle thing. And I do think because Madam Walker's main product, I mean, you can see this original tin and behind me, she had before and after pictures where you could see her hair was very short because she had these scalp infections. And then when she used this formula, which was really simple, it was wash your hair more often. And then an ointment like Vaseline called Petrolatum and with sulfur in it. And sulfur was at that point revolutionary. Now we don't use sulfur in petroleum products, but then it really did make a difference. It healed the scalp, it made the scalp healthy, her hair could grow back. But people are looking for a miracle at this point. And if you've overprocessed your hair, if you have, you know, some, if you have psoriasis, there are other reasons why hair won't grow. Now there's, you know, now Nutrafol seems to be something that people believe in that helps hair grow. But it really is the basic hygiene. It's really the basic hair care and finding what works for you. Now, the other part is some people, you know, everybody has different hair textures and one person's hair might be thin. One person's hair might be very thick. One person might have a very tight curl. One person might have a loose curl. And you can see a style that looks great on somebody else and really want that style. It's not really going to work for your hair. And I just remember several years ago, a girlfriend of mine, I hadn't seen her in a while. And, you know, and her hair was just like, you know, all the, you know, just halo coming out. And I said, girl, love your hair. She said, this is a wig. So, you know. You and I certainly at 71 have had my personal hair journey. I had very long braids when I was a kid. You know, I was very tender-headed. My mother was very patient with me. And then when I wanted to take swimming lessons when I was 12, I got a perm because my dad was president of a company that made perms. And that, you know, and that was to so that I could take swimming lessons. And in high school, I, you know, I wore my hair chemically straightened. And then my senior year in high school, it would, in 1969, people were starting to wear afros. My father was very, very much against that. But my mother took me to the Walker Beauty School, where the students rolled my hair up on permanent wave rods and gave me this big afro. And then my hair grew out and I wore an afro for the next several years. And I wore it long, I wore it short. And then over the next decade after that, I straightened it a couple more times. I really did not like the way my hair felt with a chemical straightener. I just thought it felt kind of like straw. So I haven't had any chemicals in my hair for decades, really. And I've worn my hair short and I've worn it long. And my hair now is long because when I started going gray, I really liked the gray. But when it was short, I couldn't see the gray. And so now this is the style that I wear. Now, at this point, this is kind of the style that I wear because it's really easy and I don't really want to have to fuss with my hair. I have too many other things to do. But at the same time, I really love all of the amazing variety that I see. You know, especially with young women, I just think when you're young, you just want to change it up a whole lot. I don't want to be bothered with that, but I love it that I see other people doing that.
You know, middle school, a little bit of high school. How did you feel transitioning from your hair being relaxed, being tender-headed to be able to comb your hair with no problem, mindset like, oh, I'm loving this. I don't have to do too much to my hair.
Well, you know, it was a different time where now people are much more conscious of sort of going back and forth. But at that point in the, you know, 60s, when I was in junior high and then high school, you know, basically all Black women straighten their hair one way or the other. So it wasn't really a, you know, thing. And like, then, yeah. And right. I mean, it's not, it wasn't a going back and forth. That was just the way it was. But then with Black consciousness of the 1960s, with the Black Power movement, the Civil Rights movement, that's when people really began to say, you know, I don't need to have my hair, I don't want my hair to be straight. I want my hair to be natural. And so that was, I think, really the first time that large numbers of Black women stopped straightening their hair. You know, and then that pendulum has swung back and forth, you know, through the years where we've seen, you know, some people, you know, straighten their hair because that's the way they like it. You know, the idea of straightening little girls' hair so that it's easier to comb or braiding their hair. I mean, that's a decision that people make. And I have, you know, decided that, especially because of my long family connection in hair care, that I'm not going to, you know, judge people or say that I think people ought to wear their hair one way or the other. I just say that I personally like having my hair natural. And when I did make that transition when I was in high school, I was feeling very, you know, politically aware, very politically conscious. I wanted to make that statement by having natural hair. And I will say that I, with straight hair, you know, there's a lot of praise people got for having straight hair during that period of time. And that, so that, you know, I got that, but when I transitioned to an afro, I felt more powerful. I felt more prideful and I liked that feeling.
One more question that she has for you. How do you feel about the licensing of either get your natural hair, get a license or get your cosmetology license? Mm. But a lot of people are fighting against it. They basically say you shouldn't have to have a license for natural hair. Yeah. Well, a lot of cosmetologists are trying to get you to get that. Like in North Carolina, we have the natural hair licensing down here, as well as the cosmetologist. You get either or. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, you know, it is. It's I mean, cause, and then let's add the other piece of beauty schools don't require white cosmetologists to know how to deal with hair of people from African descent. Mm-hmm. And if we have to learn how to do straighter hair, everybody should learn how to care for all textures of hair, to care for textured hair. But, you know, I will say historically, the Walker Company and a woman in particular, Marjorie Stewart Joyner, who was principal of all of the Walker schools in the 1920s, was really at the forefront of licensing and making sure that people were learning anatomy, that they were learning dermatology, that they were learning about various skin and scalp diseases. And that was part of the licensing process. So I do think there is something that is useful about people needing to learn about those other pieces. Mm-hmm. I think when it becomes a barrier to somebody being able to make a living, that we have to really evaluate and critique what that means. But I think there's one thing, if you're just in your kitchen or in your basement and you're doing hair for your friends,
yeah,
that's one thing. But if you're going to start trying, making money, if you're going to then try to deal with people who are actually losing their hair because of alopecia or because of psoriasis or because of hygiene, that it is important, I think, to have some kind of formal instruction so that you are able to really help your clients.
Thank you. So what do you
think? And what do you think?
Well, in my opinion, okay, if you're doing it at the house, I'm totally agree with you. If you're doing it at the house, fine. Okay. But if you're making profit, I think at least if you don't do the natural hair licensing, at least some kind of sanitation. Like the basics of how to clean your combs, your brushes, and learn a little bit about scalp diseases. But here's the thing. Some of the natural hair schools, I don't think they teach all the depth of everything because they leave it for the cosmetology schools to do the rest. So I think it's like they have some, but not like what you really, really need to know behind. Because I actually got the book, M'lady. I know she got some of her stuff in there. They teach you how to braid hair. This right here, I have this book right here.
Right.
And it has stuff teaching you how to take care of scalp diseases. And she wrote it in this book in here. But some people don't give the full of the textbook. It's like they skim through it.
Right. I mean, and if it's like anything, if you're dealing with somebody's body.
Yes.
I just think you're right. You need to know sanitation. You need to know, sort of some basic first aid and those kinds of things. I just think that's important, for your, because you could be sued if you don't know that. So if it's any other kind of profession, if you really want to be seen, I think, as a professional, to if you have a 6 weeks course every other year, just some kind of check in. What are the new any industry changes over time. If you're a lawyer, you have to take continuing education classes. If you're a doctor, you have to take continuing education classes. Mm-hmm. And I just think for our own, sort of pride of being a professional to take something. And there's also the growth that comes from interacting with other people who are in the same profession. There's something to be said about checking in every 24 months or every 36 months, my opinion.
You're right. You're right about that. So what are the next steps for you?
So for me, the next steps are this. I am, as I say, I'm editing the manuscript for the first major biography on Alelia Walker and her life during the Harlem Renaissance, and it will be out next year. So that's, it's more complicated and difficult than I think most people, people say, I want to write a book. Writing a book is really, really hard work. And this is really challenging. So I will really be glad to be finished with that. And then when the book comes out next year, I will do a lot, book tours and a lot of speeches. I do a lot of public speaking now. And so that will continue. But I also I have to tell you that some of that that's just fun for me. I enjoyed sharing the story, but I have some other things in my life that I'm really interested in doing. And some of it is traveling. I have not done some of the international traveling that I really would like to do. There are a whole lot of books in my house that are not read. And so I'm interested in that, but I also am interested in just using my voice to speak up for others. And one of the good things about being at this stage in life and not being employed by somebody else is that I can say what I think without worrying about whether somebody's going to fire me. And so that is, you know, I wish for all of your viewers that they can, you know, that they can get to this stage in life if they're not already there, that you can speak up for other people who might not be able to speak up for themselves. And that for me is, you know, it's part of the lesson of Madam Walker's life, that when she became successful, rather than just sort of saying, well, now I've made it, doesn't matter, let other people be on their own, I'm able to speak up. And I try to do that whenever I can.
Any movies?
You know, I actually do hope that this new book will give me another opportunity to, you know, to do a series. I actually would work with Netflix again, but I just wouldn't work with those particular showrunners and writers, because I don't think their mission is aligned with mine. Let us just say it that way. But I think that the I think that some of the executives at Netflix knew that there were some problems with this, and you know, but they have a whole lot of projects and they can't get in the weeds with everything. So I think, you know, Netflix or some one of the other streamers, I would be very interested in telling this. This is a really another really exciting story.
It is this history, man. If you do not know about Madam C.J. Walker, again, shame on you. And she's not saying not watch the Netflix version, but there's another movie out there that y'all really should pay attention to, okay?
Yeah, you know, and listen, be entertained. As I say, I mean, I thought Octavia was great, and I thought she got who Madam Walker was. She brought it to the screen. It was the story around her that was the problem for me.
Yes. Let me ask you one last question. I always play a game. Which one of you has to go before you leave me, okay? And this is which one has to go, okay? Hair mask. And it's going to be products because you deal with products. Hair mask, hair grease, and let me see, shampoo. Because you know they had like the co-wash type thing now going on.
Right. So you're saying which one would I eliminate? Or
yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, you need shampoo.
So. Yes, we need shampoo. Yeah. So I gave you one to keep automatically, the shampoo.
You gotta have that.
You got the hair mask and you got the hair grease.
Yeah, so I don't know if I had to eliminate something, the mask would probably be the thing. Conditioning is important, but
why?
So I'm laughing because when I was growing up in my household, we couldn't call it hair grease.
Why? What do you have to call it?
Now we would say the name of the product. You know, it was Glossine or Madam Walker's hair conditioning cream. But it was so hair grease was Royal Crown and Blue Magic. So, yes. But I'm just laughing because I know that's what everybody else called it.
Yes, you know, Blue Magic. Everybody loves some Blue Magic. Everybody. But right, let me ask you this question, right? Because I know I'm saying we'll let you go and stuff. Do you stop using hair grease, or do you still use? Because some people are like, don't use hair grease, don't use this, don't use oils. It's like so many don'ts.
No, well, listen, I'm going to show you this. So this is one of our products that we had the limited edition at Walmart, mm-hmm. and the consistency looks like hair grease, mm-hmm. but it's made to have the same look, but it's called Wonderful Hair and Scalp Balm to Oil, but it doesn't have petrolatum. It doesn't have that old sort of sulfur heavy Vaseline. It's just, it's a more of an ointment that really melts when you put it on. So it has the look of that, you know, Madam Walker's original product. But the ingredients are much lighter. And that is what I use on my hair.
Because your hair is beautiful, by the way. Like I said it earlier, but your hair is stunning. But a lot of people don't realize back then, a lot of the ingredients is all they had. And I was accustomed to using it, and it actually helped. Now, fast forward, they're doing a lot of, you know, understanding about what the product can do to you now. Because before, nobody really did a research and history of anything. They just knew they grew their hair. Now you get all the research in. now you know what to put in, what not to put in people's head. And you know, sometimes I hate saying this, but people don't read the back of anything. They just buy it, they see the commercial and keep going. So I'm glad that you took the time out to just explain how to use that product.
Yeah, you know, and I think that it is, again, 100 years ago when Madam Walker did this original Madam Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower, which was petrolatum, that's Vaseline, petroleum jelly, and mm-hmm. sulfur. That was revolutionary for the time. And it was a very heavy, you know, very heavy ointment, a very heavy grease. But that worked then. And we were trying to deal with our tightly coiled hair and to be able to comb it and soften it without it breaking. I mean, that was our, you know, because if your hair is very coily, as you know, if you try to bring a comb through it, it's going to break off. And so we needed to soften it in some kind of way to be able to get a comb through it or to be able to braid it or to be able to style it. But, you know, fast forward, we've had 100 years of research and development. Mm-hmm. And so where we've been afraid of moisture because it would make your hair go back, what we need is moisture. But we need moisture of a different kind, a moisture that's going to condition our hair. And so it is a learning process, I think. And with all of this research and development, where there are all kinds of products now that allow you to put moisture in your hair and allow you to have some versatility.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. I really appreciate you. I hope that you continue making your tours around the world and giving us all the knowledge of Madam C.J. Walker, because this is history and this is very, very important. You got any last words? Now, all your links will be at the bottom, so they can be able to reach out to you. So I appreciate you for taking time out and giving me some history lessons.
Well, I thank you very much for letting me be able to speak with the folks in your audience. And, you know, just hope that my goal, as I say, is really to use Madam Walker's story as a way to inspire people, whether they want to be in business or whether they're, no matter what they're doing, whether it's hair care business or something else, but also, you know, as a way to encourage people to learn their own personal family history, because everybody's family has heroes. Everybody's family has people who've made a way out of no way. And that's really my goal, is to really encourage others.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And until next time, audience, we'll talk to you later. Bye.